Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, despite half the members of the Matthews Board of Commissioners warming to the transit plan, they continue to use a lobbyist in Raleigh to advocate against it. CMS is preparing for budget troubles, facing a loss of $100 million in federal funding. Meanwhile, they may find themselves in the middle of a hate crime investigation over an altercation between two students, one a Muslim, allegedly injured in an altercation. Governor Josh Stein delivers his first State of the State address, calling for bipartisanship and efficiency, and promising to quickly sign the Hurricane Helene relief bill. Tensions build on two area campuses over support for a Palestinian activist, the other against Hamas. Johnson C. Smith University faces federal cuts from the Trump administration, and the ACC tournament is in town. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News education reporter James Farrell. Mary Ramsey joins us, local government accountability reporter from the Charlotte Observer. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg, I think we've met before. Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. North Carolina's new governor, Josh Stein, delivered his first State of the State address on Wednesday night, laying out plans for the next couple of years. This would seem a difficult speech to make for a Democratic governor in front of a majority-controlled Republican House, which has sometimes been hostile to the executive branch. How would you describe the atmosphere in the chamber on Wednesday night?
Well, I think we can safely say it was better than what we had when President Trump addressed Congress recently. I know that's a very low bar. There was a call from the governor for bipartisanship, and there were some moments of bipartisanship, such as relief for Hurricane Helene, although the legislature is looking at a couple of bills that are about half as much as what Governor Stein wants. He wants about $1.1 billion. I think they're looking more in the range of $500 million. They agreed on things like raises for law enforcement officers, for public school teachers. They did not agree on issues such as private school vouchers, with the legislature obviously passing those, supporting those, and the governor pointing out that that will cost the state about $7.5 billion over the next 10 years. And also, the governor was adamant about wanting to put a halt to upcoming corporate tax cuts, saying that the state cannot afford to do that, and also that he would prefer to give tax cuts to the middle class. So you saw pretty clearly that while there are a couple of issues of bipartisan agreement, there are still plenty of things that they do not have the same views on.
The one big area of bipartisan agreement is the need for Hurricane Helene relief. As you mentioned, there are three different versions of this. The House has a version. They're proposing $500 million. The Senate has theirs. They're proposing $533 million. And, of course, the governor wants over $1 billion to come through the legislature. All of this is in flux at the moment. But he stressed the importance of this money, and he told lawmakers that he is ready to sign a bill.
That's why I'm working with President Trump and his cabinet and our congressional delegation to seek billions more in federal funds, ASAP. And that's why I urge you. That's why I urge you to pass the $500 million Western North Carolina recovery bill.
He put the lowest dollar figure on that bill, the House figure. Is he siding with the House over the Senate? And if that wasn't just a slip of the tongue or shorthand, why is he mentioning the lowest number?
I am just assuming that the reason is he's going to take whatever he can get, and he thinks that's what he can get. Because, again, it was only a couple weeks ago that he was saying $1.1 billion, although he knows the legislature is not going to do that. But, yeah, I don't know why he went with the lowest figure in the speech.
You mentioned that he wants to not have the tax cuts for what did you say, the rich or the or corporations?
The corporate tax. You know, there's a stair-step corporate tax that kicks in each year by year.
But he did say he wants to cut taxes on the middle class. Some Democrats have been predicting that we're heading toward the edge of a fiscal cliff. The Republicans in the House leadership and Senate leadership say that's not true. They don't believe that's true. So why is the Democratic governor, in the face of other Democrats saying, hey, we're going to go off the cliff here, talking about tax cuts?
Because politicians talk about tax cuts and they pick, you know, which constituency they want to provide tax cuts. And for a Democrat, it is a, you know, pretty standard move to say, look, let's not give tax cuts to the wealthy, but let's give them to the working people, to the middle class. So that is classic Democratic orthodoxy. I think one of the things that's interesting is what you just mentioned, Mike. When Senator Berger and Speaker Destin Hall were here a couple weeks ago with the Charlotte Business Alliance, they reiterated, I asked Senator Berger a question about what about these forecasts about declining revenues, and he just said again, flat out, as he has said several times, I don't believe those forecasts. I think that the revenue is going to end up being higher. It's not something to worry about. The governor said in his remarks the other night that he thought, what, an $825 million loss if those corporate tax cuts go through. So clearly we have a lot of numbers flying around here and nobody's agreeing on those numbers.
Mary Curtis.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out some areas of disagreement, shall we say, amidst all this talk of bipartisanship. As you talked about vouchers, Eric talked about that, and it's turned out, as many predicted, that many folks who have money in the top tiers, who have kids in private schools, are taking advantage of these vouchers, and they would not have been eligible with the previous law. So that's going to be an area of tension. And he did take a little dig at the Trump administration when he said, yes, he was looking for efficiencies in state government, but he was going to do it with a scalpel and not a chainsaw, which I think is a contrast to what many people are accusing Donald Trump and Elon Musk, the whatever shadow president, of doing in the federal government, where they are slashing so many jobs and then they have to hire people back because of many of them are essential jobs.
Yeah, the state has been talking about, in the General Assembly at least, setting up their own version of DOGE to try to weed out fraud, waste, and abuse. And Governor Stein, as you mentioned, agrees with the sentiment, but he told lawmakers we need to, quote, ensure our government is run effectively and efficiently because people should know that their tax dollars are being well spent. But he added, let's get this right. Let's use a scalpel, not a chainsaw. That's a clear swipe at Elon Musk and Doge and the Trump administration. Stein says his office will set up an impact center to accomplish the goal of cutting waste, fraud, and abuse. Was he any more specific about what that might entail? Don't know. Okay.
I don't see so. And then, of course, Destin Hall, the House Speaker, had his response to the state of the state, and which, you know, he brought up some Trump-aligned issues that, of course, the GOP and the state, they're following, like immigration.
And we will talk about that in a moment. As we've spoken about countless times before, North Carolina's public schools are chronically underfunded. When we talk about that, we usually focus on teacher pay, but Governor Stein took a different tack this week. He lamented the state of the schools, public schools, their physical plants, and he asked for $4 billion to fix them.
Too many of our schools are overcrowded, or use trailers, or have old leaking roofs and broken heating and air conditioning. It is 2025. We should not have to send kids home from school because the heat doesn't work.
Can't argue with that. But will that bill, will the legislature be inclined to give him what he wants in terms of money, or any money for that matter?
I don't think so. I would be very surprised. I mean, it seems like they're aligned on the teacher pay aspect, but I don't think they're going to give him, certainly they're not going to support a $4 billion bond. I would be shocked if that happens, Mary.
Yeah, and we saw here in Charlotte, I think the students at West Mech that walked out because of the shape of the physical plant and the way it's maintained. And we see throughout the state that particularly areas of low income students, a lot of free and reduced lunch, minority students, that some of these plants, the physical plants, are really not up to par. And they'll go to other schools for different events and they'll see the contrast. So definitely, I think he was looking toward a need, whether he gets that money or not, of course, as Eric says, may be pretty doubtful.
So getting back to this feeling of bipartisanship in Raleigh on Wednesday night. Governor Stein told legislators, if those of us who believe in the possibility of bipartisanship look to Washington, we will surely become discouraged.
We do not need to be pulled into those political games. We can create something better, something forward-looking right here in North Carolina, and we can do it together.
And that sentiment was echoed in House Speaker Destin Hall's Republican response, which followed the governor's State of the State address.
While we may have strong disagreements with Governor Stein on important issues, Republicans understand that real leaders don't need to shout down the opposition, and that real leadership means being willing to listen even where we may disagree.
That's the topic of yesterday's program. This is a honeymoon period for the governor, but this isn't the first time that legislative leaders have expressed more of a willingness to work with Stein than with his predecessor, Governor Cooper. Is that simply because the bloom is still on the rose here, or is there more to it than that? Eric.
I think for the moment it's simply because the bloom is still on the rose. And it's funny, Mike, when you're playing that cut of Speaker Hall, I mean, he's taking a shot at Democrats, even as he's calling for bipartisanship, of course. And as Mary alluded to, the governor took his own shot with the scalpel rather than the chainsaw. So, again, it's a very low bar. They're a little bit better than what's going on in Washington, but you still see plenty of partisan rancor, and particularly some of the issues you mentioned, Mike, immigration, school funding. There are some pretty clear issues. I think Speaker Hall also mentioned transgender.
Yes, let me play that for you, because despite all these mutual calls for bipartisanship, he just couldn't walk away, and why should he, from Republican talking points.
The people of our state agree that policies like secure borders, law and order, school choice, cutting taxes to keep more of our hard-earned money, and keeping men out of women's sports are just plain common sense.
Mary, some Democrats in other states, like California Governor Gavin Newsom, are now saying that allowing transgender women in female sports is a mistake. Governor Newsom says he calls it deeply unfair. That's a quote from his podcast that he's now doing, which he does by talking to people on the right. This is a shift in response from the last election. What, if anything, has Josh Stein had to say about that aspect of the culture wars?
Eric, I'm not sure what his feeling is. I don't think he says much about the transgender issue. I know that when the Republicans came back in the state legislature, quite a few of their bills were about transgender athletes playing in women's sports, even though I think the numbers say it's in the single digits in the state. So I don't think it's a huge issue, but Republicans can't say anything without one talking about immigration. And of course, here in North Carolina, there's always that issue of the sheriffs cooperating with ICE, whether they will or won't in different counties. There's pressure for them to do it. Of course, they have to mention banning DEI and transgender athletes, because that is a big deal. Gavin Newsom obviously wants to run for president, and he's having people like Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon on his podcast and trying to play that game. I think we all know that he really wants to be president, and that's behind his move to the right, I would say, or they felt that issue really hurt Kamala Harris because of the ad that ran incessantly. So,
and of course, Mike, the issue. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have 30 seconds. Go.
Oh, I was just going to say very quickly, the 2-year budget negotiation and whether that one vote short of being able to override the veto for the Republicans, that's really when we're going to find out how this relationship works or doesn't.
Okay. When we come back, we have some things to talk about with regard to Matthew's continuing on-again, off-again love affair or hate affair with the transit plan that's in Raleigh right now for consideration, and more on the legislature cutting back on powers of the executive branch, this time targeting Jeff Jackson, who's the new attorney general. And we'll talk about North Carolina and South Carolina moves against diversity, equity, and inclusion. All that and more when the roundup continues at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Tonks on the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about all kinds of things this morning with Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary Ramsey joins us from the Charlotte Observer. She's the local government accountability reporter. And James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter. And we have a slew of things to talk about with him in a moment or two. We talked a bit last week about the town of Matthews and their board of commissioners softening their position on the transit plan. At first, they were unanimously opposed because none of the plans includes guarantees of a Silver Line commuter train coming to Matthews. But now three of the town commissioners are beginning to see other possible benefits to these plans, and there are four of them at the moment. But they continue to pay the lobbyists they hired in Raleigh to go and advocate against it. But on Monday, Mary Ramsey, one of the commissioners, Mark Tufano, introduced a measure to fire that consulting firm, claiming that the firm, EVQ Strategic, failed to answer his questions. Other commissioners accused Tufano of embarrassing and unprofessional behavior. Why? What's this all about? What's going on here?
Yes, so this is all seems to be really rooted in that shift in position by Commissioner Tufano and a couple others on the board that was made public last week. This is a Raleigh-based consultant that the town has been paying $5,000 a month to 12-month contract, so it'll be $60,000 total to advocate for, and technically all of the city's legislative priorities, or the town, I should say, but to advocate against the transit bill. Commissioner Tufano said he has been reaching out to the lobbyist, asking for reports back on what the work that the lobbying firm has been doing and the response he's been getting from legislatures, but to no avail. He says he's also reached out to elected officials at the state and local level from other municipalities to sort of hear what they're hearing from the lobbyist, which is where the embarrassing and unprofessional comments from Mayor John Higdon came. Mayor Higdon, who has been a vocal advocate against the transit bill, basically responded, "You are incredibly naive to think that a lobbyist would put such things in writing, because then reporters like me and Eric and James could get them as public record, and that he should simply be calling the lobbyist or meeting him in person."
So I was reading your article about this, and that's what leapt out off the page to me. You report that some of those same officials have said that the lobbying firm intentionally avoids creating public records of the communications about the bill. I have to ask, they're being paid with public money, these people. Would that be a violation of state law? Aren't things like this supposed to be public record?
That would be a better question for someone with a law degree. That being said, it certainly jumped out to me, too, as a firm believer in public records. Something that I have been advised before in situations that when I'm told that there are no public records because conversations were had by phone are to request phone records and any notes from those phone calls. So perhaps that could be an avenue for myself and others to get more details. But yeah, it was something that the town manager and Mayor Higdon said very bluntly, that a lobbyist of this level is simply not going to put things in writing because that could mean the town tipping their hand in terms of their strategy.
That's a lobbyist at the $5,000 a month level. Eric, go ahead. Turn yourself on. Eric, unmute yourself.
Sorry, it's been 5 years. How could I know? It's only been 5 years. Being the Business Journal, we always like to look at money. And I think that's one of the interesting things here, is that this turn from unanimous opposition seems to be driven by, pardon the awful pun, the $5 million in annual road money that would come from this tax, and some of the commissioners realizing, hey, $5 million plus is a lot of money. Remember, I think the Matthews budget is something like $38 million this year, something like that. So this is significant money, and you see that across the board in the towns with the road money in particular, because not only will they receive that money, they will control it. They direct right where it goes. So that seems to be a big swing factor now with Matthews.
Yeah, we talked about that last week, because that's been part of this conversation since the very beginning. And it's all of a sudden dawned on them that this money is theirs for the taking to use as they choose. And that seems to be a revelation at the moment. Mary, you also report that this debate on the issue of confidentiality of what's going on between the lobbyists and people in Raleigh, they've instructed the town attorney to look into legal means for providing private updates on lobbying efforts to town officials. What does that mean?
Yes, so there was a lot of debate during this discussion about whether this was something that the town council or town commission, I should say, could simply be getting updates on in a closed session. North Carolina's open meeting laws are very specific and somewhat strict about what can and can't be discussed in a closed session. Generally, it has to be things like discussing a personnel issue or an economic development deal that's very competitive. But yeah, so they did agree to keep paying the lobbyist, but with the caveat that the county attorney would look into means for being able to brief the whole council, because there was a lot of discussion and debate amongst some members of the commission who said, well, we've just been calling up the lobbyist, or we've been going to Raleigh and meeting with him in person and getting plenty of information. And then others, including Commissioner Tufano, who insinuated that they feel like they're more in the dark. So the idea that there needs to be a more uniform process for this lobbyist.
You also report that at times this debate on county commission on the town commission became heated and at times became personal. As an example, Mayor John Higdon, who has never hidden his opposition to the plan, which he views as inequitable because they are now slated to get bus rapid transit instead of rail, which he says, insists, in fact, that it doesn't work anywhere it's been tried. Higdon said this week that he didn't want to mince words about the reversal of opinion by some of these commission members. He said, quote, having three of our commissioners side with Charlotte and the county and against our best interest is a complete and total sellout of Matthews taxpayers. How was that received?
Not very well. There were a lot of very heated moments during Monday's debate. At one point, Commissioner Ken McCool asked Tufano if he was doing this because of his change in position. Tufano denied that and then responded to McCool by accusing McCool of smirking and asking if that smirk was meant to insinuate Tufano was lying. McCool did not respond, but another commissioner, Commissioner Renee Garner, responded that her smirk was meant to imply that. So things got very personal. The word unprofessional was thrown around a lot, embarrassing. So definitely very divisive, and seemed like a lot of tension that sort of had been festering for about a week or so since the news of the change in positions became public, really came out during this debate over the lobbyist.
So to get away now from the smirks and the snark and the personal attacks, let's go someplace where things are calmer. Let's go back to Raleigh for several weeks now. The North Carolina Senate has been working to block Attorney General Jeff Jackson from challenging Donald Trump's executive orders. Senate Bill 58 passed on Tuesday on a 29-19 vote, with all the Democrats present voting against it. Here's Democratic State Senator Greg Meyer.
We should not take away the Attorney General's ability to represent the citizens of the state of North Carolina when he has the opportunity to defend our state for jobs, for funding, for health care, for things that our people desperately need.
Another Democrat, Senator Terrence Everett of Granville, proposed an amendment that would have delayed implementation for 4 years on the ground that voters chose Jackson with the understanding that he would have the power to challenge executive actions. Eric, isn't that his job?
That is part of his job, and so we have a long history of that happening in North Carolina, including by the current governor when he was attorney general for two terms.
So here's a question that we ask repeatedly now in this new era. Would that be constitutional, this law?
That's a good question. I'm going to defer to Mary's answer, Mary Ramsey's answer, that it would take a legal mind to answer that, but it certainly would seem that way. The attorney general is there to take legal action. So I'm not sure how constitutional this idea is, but clearly this is a continuation of Republican policy, which we have seen, trying to limit the powers of governor and council of state when they disagree. Look no further, Mike, than the fact that the state auditor now is overseeing the elections board.
So, Mary, is this likely to pass both houses? And if so, is the governor likely to veto it? And given the fact that they no longer have a supermajority, what then?
Well, then we'll see what happens. This is pesky North Carolina that voted for Trump, but also voted for many Democrats down ballot. If all the Democrats stick together in the House, because it's no longer a veto-proof majority that Republicans have, they can sustain Josh Stein's veto. But it's interesting because Republicans are saying, well, you know, people voted for Trump. They want his policies, but they voted for Jeff Jackson too. And the argument is that by him fighting some of these executive orders, he has saved, as your quote said, the state's jobs, many of them, and some money for healthcare. And so all of those attorneys general that banded together to fight the executive orders, their states are reaping the benefits of a judge freezing all of that. So, you know, it's, they voted for Jeff Jackson. He is the attorney general, but, you know, they are chipping away at his powers.
Yeah. And the argument that they voted for Trump and therefore they want these policies is losing some of its luster, as we are seeing at town halls across the country, including here last night in North Carolina in the western part of the state, where it was nothing more than a shouting match of constituents yelling at a congressman. Jeff Jackson was prolific in his communications with his constituents when he was in Congress. He was a social media maven who received national attention for his TikTok posts. What has he said, Eric, about this attempt to remove some of the power from his office? Anything?
Well, of course, he says he is entirely against it, that as Mary Curtis just mentioned, that his work has saved the state from losing research money, from losing federal jobs, and will continue to do that as you know, the government efficiency is carried out in Washington. So Jeff Jackson has been pretty adamant that he intends to fight the Trump administration at every turn with every maneuver that he has in his power.
And as you say, Mike, as the Trump administration, some of their policies losing its losing their luster, and people are questioning how he's handling the economy, maybe aligning yourself with Trump for the state Republicans might, you know, they may not be quite so loud about it in the future. We'll see.
The Trump administration started this elimination of anything relating to diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's been wiped from all the websites in the federal government, all the agencies, and private businesses are following suit, and now North and South Carolina are trying to take a similar path. On Tuesday, the North Carolina Senate approved legislation that would ban DEI programs in public schools and put new rules in place for how teachers can discuss racism and sexism in the classroom. Mary, what is the bill say?
Mary Curtis?
Yeah. Mary Curtis,
it
yes,
says, yeah, that they can't teach what is called divisive concepts in the schools, and they're attacked because these bills are attacked, one, because they're thought to be unconstitutional, but also because it's very vague. So many of these bills depend on how you interpret it. And even one of the
let me ask you for a definition. Did they define what a divisive concept is?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yes, it's just, quote, divisive concepts. Oh, it says, including a notion that a person's race, there's 12 such concepts. A person's race or sex makes them inherently superior to others, makes them inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, determines their moral character, or makes them responsible for the actions committed in the past by other members of the same race or sex. I really don't think those things are taught at all in schools. And so much of it depends upon how it makes a student feel. And it's interesting because they should just say white students, how it makes them feel. Because I don't think anybody ever mentions how Black students feel when their history isn't being taught, how the truthfulness of America is not being taught. It all seems to be to coddle the comfort of white students, but the bills don't say that.
And in speaking of divisive, it appears that some people believe the mere existence of DEI is divisive. Senator Lisa Grafstein, a Democrat from Raleigh, told fellow lawmakers, inclusion is not a divisive word, nor should it be. And she offered an amendment to make the bill apply to private schools that accept taxpayer-funded vouchers. That was voted down. Some critics of this bill have questioned its constitutionality. In New Hampshire, where a similar bill was in place, it was struck down as being too vague. And as these moves grow across the country, could they run afoul of currently existing civil rights laws, like the Civil Rights Act or other acts put in place for protective measures?
Mary. Yes, they could, very much so, because I think it's interesting. Diversity and inclusion policies were put in place to fight the centuries-old discrimination against minorities. Because let's face it, for most of this country's history, affirmative action has meant white, straight men. And now the way the Trump administration and Republicans are defining it, it seems to be whenever a woman or a person of a different ability or a person of color is in a job, that in and of itself equals is opposite to meritocracy, when in fact, you know, I wrote in one of my roll call columns, when the Tuskegee Airmen came out of World War II as some of the best pilots, Top Gun pilots, they couldn't get jobs in commercial airlines, even though their qualifications were incredible, because the owners of the airlines said, well, what would people think if they saw a Black pilot? And the Supreme Court and diversity policies had to come in just to make qualified people be considered for jobs. But Republicans are turning it on its head, that whole concept of trying to widen the pool to get the best and the brightest. And in that way, I think it will run afoul of civil rights laws. And Lyndon Johnson's 1965 executive order saying federal contractors had to make sure they looked for diversity to make sure the best people were getting jobs. Trump is his executive orders are pretty much saying, no, that's out now. So expect a lot of lawsuits.
And as I mentioned, similar things are happening in South Carolina in their legislature, where an effort to bar the use of diversity, equity, and inclusion by schools was killed on the House floor by Democrats. DOGE is making deep cuts into many programs in Washington that have tentacles that reach out across the country. And now Johnson C. Smith University says it is bracing for cuts to student aid and other services. What precisely, Mary, are they anticipating?
Well, Johnson C. Smith is a private university, so there's not a lot of things that they can fight this, but a lot of federal programs actually help their students, first-generation students, veteran students, and these are policies that will affect them in a federal, because if the federal cuts happen, they rely on loans and grants and work-study programs. So this could very much affect them. They're going to have to make it up with private donors, maybe corporate partners. So, you know, HBCUs traditionally are underfunded, and we can say that they were founded for inclusion, because African Americans weren't being accepted for the most part in universities at those times, and they have never excluded. HBCUs have always had faculty and student body of all races, of all genders, and you know they're going to be fighting it and trying to make it up, but it's going to be difficult because the federal government, their tentacles do reach into so many of the programs and scholarships and programs for veterans.
A lot of news coming out of CMS this week. We're going to touch on all of it with WFAE's education reporter, James Farrell. And we still have more to talk about after that, so don't go away. A lot of news this week on the News Roundup on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis from RollCall.com, Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, and James Farrell, our education reporter here at WFAE News. And James, we're going to put you through a workout now because Johnson C. Smith is talking about maybe some money problems because of DOGE. Meanwhile, Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools are facing the loss of $100 million. In federal funding. This has nothing to do with DOGE or the cutbacks taking place at the Department of Education at the moment. This has to do with ending of COVID relief dollars, which they have been receiving since March of 2020. First of all, what did those funds support?
Those funds supported a whole host of different programs, initiatives, supplies. They helped fund laptops and devices for students, which was common in schools across the country that were able to get to one-to-one device-to-student ratios with this funding. They also supported positions and teachers and things like that. We know that CMS kind of did some work last year to try to prevent a reduction in workforce with this funding. So what's kind of left for them to figure out this year as they these funds become completely unavailable is sort of more of the programs and supplies and things like that.
Well, they've known this is coming since, I think, 2020. So they are prepared, right?
Yeah, well, again, last year they did put a lot of work into trying to prevent at least a reduction in workforce. And yeah, correct. They know this is coming, but there's an added complication this year that, as we've been talking about with DOGE cuts and questions about the Department of Education, that there are a lot of other revenue sources that are a little more uncertain this year. Yeah. Certainly they've talked about Title I funding potentially being at risk and other things like that.
So the ending of these funds is in addition to the federal funding being ended by the Trump administration for diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. CMS had three grants terminated, which they are appealing, but all of this has CMS doing some belt tightening, according to Kelly Klutz, the district's chief financial officer.
As we navigate through all these complexities, we have to get tight on everything, remembering that more than 75% of our operating budget is salary and benefits. We're already started the tightening in our allotment process this year by removing some vacant positions.
And you report that roughly 60% of the district's funds coming from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund, or ESSER, went towards salaries and benefits. Do they have an alternative source of funding for those things?
Well, yes. So a lot, again, that was all of the, that 60% of funding was what was funding the positions that they say they were able to secure last year, and they were able to stave off a reduction in workforce last year. So again, that remaining 40% funds those programs, the supplies and things from the ESSER funding, and that's really what they're kind of trying to work through this year.
So at the same time they're talking about the loss of these funds and other potential cuts coming their way, they're also considering teacher pay boosts and a new bonus program. How?
Yeah, so that has really been one of the things they're trying to focus on. The school board has goals that are set around different academic benchmarks, predominantly around literacy and math. So trying to find ways to stay competitive with retaining and recruiting teachers is a really big priority. They are hoping for what they've hinted at being ultimately a 5% increase in the teacher supplement. At this past week's meeting, they talked about that being maybe a roughly 4% increase across the board with an additional 1% increase for veteran teachers with 15 years of experience. And yeah, like you mentioned, that bonus program would be funded from federal dollars through the Title I program and would be available at Title I schools for teachers who show improvements in math.
Remind us of what Title I is for.
Title I funding is a federal revenue source that goes to schools based on the number of low-wealth students or students from low-wealth families that go to that school.
And that program would also apply to the district's 14 Title I high schools. It would give 32 teachers the opportunity to earn up to $15,000 in bonuses. If those teachers are successful, if that happens, and those teachers are successful in reaching their goals, how much money are we talking about here?
In total, the investment was something around more than $700,000 from the Title I funding. Again, for the teachers themselves, it could be up to $15,000 in bonuses if successful. I believe they also need a principal recommendation, and they need to show certain benchmarks in math as well.
A couple of weeks ago, CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill sent out a video apology for the way the system handled notification of parents about threats that were targeting multiple schools in the system. And this week, they rolled out a new plan for communicating school threats. And Dr. Hill sent that notification out to parents in a 6-minute video.
First, I want to reiterate that our established safety and security policies are clear that we will not tolerate threats or violence of any kind. Additionally, established safety protocols were followed impeccably while we worked with law enforcement to investigate threats against our schools last month. We are committed to continuous improvement across our district, and the enhancements we've made to the communication process regarding threats against our schools are now streamlined to better ensure that all Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools are aligned.
So what are those communication improvements?
So the video didn't really lay out specifically what changed exactly, but some of the key points from that was that they wanted to make sure that every school in the system was following the same procedures, and they also just said that parents should expect that they might be getting more notifications from the school, trying to be a little more proactive about reaching out about different potential threats or incidents or things like that.
Meanwhile, a female student at Ardrey Kell High School suffered multiple broken bones in her face and jaw, which her family alleges was the result of an incident in a math class between this 14-year-old student, whose name we are not releasing, even though we know it, and a football player. She was wearing hijab, and they are calling this anti-Muslim bullying. The family is requesting her name not be mentioned. That's why we're respecting it. But one of her friends says the girl told her the male student had been repeatedly making fun of her religion and added this.
I go to the house. She's not a person that is easily recognizable. She was beaten up to a point where her eye is not able to open. The bruisings hide every single structure of her face.
So what do we know about this incident, this alleged incident?
So at this point, we mostly know what the family has told us. You know, they allege that the student who hit the girl was using racial slurs and said something along the lines of, you know, go back to your country. Worth noting, the girl is from the United States and was born in the United States. We know CMS has not really been able to confirm a lot of the specific allegations here, citing privacy laws involving students. We know that from the family has said that both students were suspended, which is something that had made the family frustrated and a little confused as to why the girl was suspended in this case. You know, the family was also very upset with the response from CMS. They felt that CMS didn't take the incident seriously enough. They claimed that, you know, they had to push for 911 to be called, things like that.
Yeah, they allege that the school did not call an ambulance promptly after the assault, instead asking the student's mother to take her to the hospital. But Tim Ivey, who's the chief operations officer at CMS, disagrees, saying the school followed protocol throughout.
Audrick Hill High School followed all policies and procedures as outlined in the board policy manual and student code of conduct, including involving law enforcement, calling 911 immediately, and providing medical attention.
Meanwhile, the 19-year-old brother of the girl who was allegedly attacked, who is also a former Audrick Hill student, says his sister told him she was often bullied for being Muslim and that her accused attacker used the B word and the N word while beating her. And he says he wasn't surprised.
I went through it as well. People call me a terrorist, all that, but you just got to keep ignoring it. And, like, I didn't think that anyone would, like, punch or anything. But then when I saw that, it was just, like, crazy.
It's difficult to understand the end of that clip because of digital artifacting, but he says, I didn't think anyone would punch her or anything like that. And when I saw that, it was just crazy to me. CMPD is now asking the FBI to investigate whether the reported assault of this 15-year-old by another student at Audrick Hill for wearing hijab was a hate crime. How unusual is it for CMPD to make such a request to the FBI?
Well, ultimately, it's up to the FBI to make those determinations, or at least that's what CMPD said in their statement yesterday. You know, and that had been kind of part of this conversation, too. The family had wanted CMS to treat this more like a hate crime in their investigative process, and CMS said it will ultimately be a determination by law enforcement. They'd be the ones that have to make that determination.
The Observer also reported that when asked for a copy of the incident report, the CMPD Records Division says it doesn't exist. That was on Wednesday. On Thursday, the department acknowledged its existence in a social media post. How do we explain that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. I know that they did, again, they mentioned that in the post yesterday, and Tim Ivey at his press conference also had said that a school resource officer was on scene and responded and, you know, made a report there and initiated the investigative process. So that's all we know on that at this point.
So protests have been held this week in a number of cities around the country, including UNC Charlotte, advocating for the release of Mahmoud Khalil. He's a former Columbia University student who was arrested by ICE and then threatened with deportation. James, remind us of his story and what he allegedly did.
Yeah, so he was a Palestinian refugee, came to the United States. He's here on a green card, and he's also married to a U.S. citizen. And we know that he was involved in some of the pro-Palestinian protests that were happening at Columbia University over the last year, where you might remember there were encampments. There was an incident where students barricaded themselves in a building. And he has been sort of targeted for his involvement there. The Trump administration says he participated in activities that aligned with Hamas, but what that actually looks like is still a little confusing. There's not a lot of clarity in terms of what he specifically did that targeted the target.
Hundreds of groups across the country protested in support of Khalil. How many people protested at this at this event at UNC Charlotte?
Yeah, so my colleague Julian Berger was there, and I think he said it was roughly two dozen students and professors that were there.
And one of the protesters at UNC Charlotte was a student and a student organizer there by the name of Sammy Randall.
From Charlotte to New York, from New York to LA, and from LA to Florida, we stand united with our students across the country and across the globe. An attack on him in this way is an attack on any of us who speak up.
So Donald Trump signed an executive order in January saying that he would deport Hamas sympathizers and revoke student visas. He also promised to combat anti-Semitism, but protesters at Tuesday's Charlotte rally called that motivation into question, saying that this is actually a suppression of free speech. Did Khalil, during the protest that he was part of at Columbia, do or say anything that directly supports Hamas?
Well, his basically, one of his big roles, he was very visible because he was a negotiator, a go-between with the university and with some of the protesters. And a lot of folks are saying this is really a First Amendment issue. He just didn't have a student visa. He has a green card. He has a wife who is 8 months pregnant, an American citizen, and he hasn't been charged with any crime. So, yes, they did look into what he was talking about. But, you know, he was pro-Palestinian. Was it supporting Hamas? And no, you know, so that's the issue for folks, even who disagree with what he said.
He has been arrested and he's being detained, interestingly enough, in Louisiana. Yesterday on NPR's Morning Edition, Michelle Martin spoke to Troy Edgar, the deputy secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. They allege Khalil came into the country on a student visa and has been fomenting anti-Semitism and supporting terrorist activity. And Michelle Martin had a lengthy exchange with Mr. Edgar that we don't have time to play in total, but it was clear that Homeland Security believes Khalil's involvement in campus protests is sufficient to deport him, and that would set a precedent. So Martin repeatedly asked some key questions.
So what is the standard? Is any criticism of the Israeli government a deportable offense?
I think that at this point, when he was entered into the country on a student visa, at any point we can go through and evaluate what his status is, and the Secretary of State.
Is any criticism of the United States government a deportable offense?
Like I said, you know, if you go through the process and you're a student and you're here on a visa and you go through at any point.
Is any criticism of the government a deportable offense?
It's like I said, you know, as a student, he comes to the United States on a student visa, applies. Well, let me put it this way, Michelle. Imagine if he came in and filled out the form and said, I want a student visa. They asked him, what are you going to do here? And
he was a student.
I'm going to go and protest and
so is protest a deportable event?
We would never have let him into the country.
Is protesting a deportable offense?
She never really received an answer to that question other than what we've already heard. But is there one? Can you be deported if you have a green card? Or is that something that courts have to decide?
A judge is looking at it, and they've blocked his deportation for the time being. Right now, they're arguing about venue. But that is why even some Jewish groups are supporting this case, because if you can protest, they say it will set a precedent for being able to be deported for having an opinion that disagrees with the government.
Well, what is this I hear, Eric, about Steph Curry serving as an assistant general manager for the Davidson College basketball teams? This is something new. Unmute yourself. 5 years we've been doing this.
Twice in one show after 5 years. He doesn't have enough to do, Mike, so he needs another job, and his side hustle is going to be trying to recruit players to play at his alma mater, Davidson, and that includes an endorsement fund, for lack of a better term, of probably in the range of $10 million that he and some other wealthy donors are going to raise.
And this is all because of NIL, the name, image, and likeness changes in the college basketball, which is changing, and football, which is changing everything, which is why Bill Belichick is at UNC Chapel Hill coming in. And speaking of basketball, the men's ACC basketball tournament is in town this week. This used to be big news, but I got to tell you, it surprised me that it was here. what have fans witnessed so far?
Well, I think it's going to get a lot noisier tonight, Mike, because you have a North Carolina Duke matchup. That is classic ACC rivalry. And this is the first time that the ACC tournament's been here in 6 years, so you're right. It's been a while, but I think the excitement may have been slow to build, but this weekend it's going to crank up.
Without Duke ace Cooper Flagg.
That's
right.
Yeah. So this contributed $167 million to the regional economy in 2019. When the last time it was here, it brought in $35.6 million to the city. Are they estimating more this time around just because of inflation?
You know, they haven't given any preliminary estimates, but the hotels were increasing rates around Uptown by 40% going into the week. So I think they're expecting some pretty good numbers.
And we have another towering figure in Charlotte to memorialize this week. Former Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board member and chair of the board, George Battle, died this week at the age of 77. Had a lot of fingers and a lot of pies and did a lot of good. James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for The Observer. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com and host of Equal Time. And Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.